February the 20th, 2007 to order. Before we start, just a reminder that we will be going on our field trip to Tillamook on Friday, and I hope that all of you will be able to be there. We'll perhaps at the end of this meeting, we'll recap a little bit about exactly where and all of those things, just a quick reminder of that. I'm going to, we have two bills today, and I'm going to open the public hearing on both bills, House Bill 2670 and Senate Bill 459. And House Bill 2670, Representative Boone, is your bill. Would you like to start?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members, for indulging me. Just been informed that there is now a third and possibly fourth version of this bill, so here we go. I was asked by a constituent of mine, for the record, my name is Representative Deborah Boone. I represent House District 32.
Thank you.
Which is the Upper Left Coast. And a fellow firefighter from, not my department, but Cannon Beach Volunteer Fire Department, asked me to submit this bill because he has heard time and time again from his colleagues, as have I, and I'm sure many of you in your districts have from your constituents who serve in the volunteer fire service and are volunteer emergency medical technicians. It's the key word there being volunteer. These people, I've just written down, I'll be very brief, but I just wanted to give you a sense of the time constraints on people, or kind of time commitments on that people give to their service. And this service is in your communities. If you live in a rural area, these are your first line workers on when you have an emergency. When you call 911, your fire department comes to your home and is usually followed shortly thereafter by the ambulance. In some areas, and I'm thinking of mostly far east part of our state and downstate, far east and lower right corners and really out there areas, sometimes they're one and the same. The ambulance service and the fire department is one and the same. And sometimes they're a long ways away. So they're on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is what I compiled as having been mutually agreed upon as about the low end of the time commitment. Weekly drills are about 3 hours, and that does not include drive time to the station or the drill site. Weekly classes can be anywhere from 3 to 6 hours, and often long drive time, for example, in my area, the people who need to recertify as first responders is minimum 16 to 20 hours. These are done at our community college, which is an hour drive each way for some people in the south part of our county. And weekend training days, that's equipment training and qualifying as a firefighter, one or two, which is enabling you to drive the equipment, basically. Family time, which means time away from family, spent all this is time away from family, including call time, drill times, all that. And then money spent. Out-of-pocket expenses include gas to driving to these calls and to drills, and sometimes the calls are quite a ways away. Classes and training, some equipment, some firefighters and emergency medical technicians supply their own radios, pagers, personal safety equipment and gear, gloves, masks, antibacterial cleaner that they have to keep in their personal rigs because you can't use them twice. And not all departments have an equipment budget. Laundry expenses, when you have to disinfect your gear, clean it up. You have to disinfect it if it's an emergency medical call, and you can't do that in your home laundry service. You have to take it out and do it industrial at a laundromat. Some laundromats don't allow it, so you have to find a fire department that has the equipment to do it. And that takes time and cost and money to do that. And this is basically a small gift from the state to these dedicated volunteers who risk their lives to save yours. And Mike Johnson from Cannon Beach Fire cannot be here today, but I'm sure when we get to the work session part that he will be, and I might have several others, but they wanted to wait until it's they can't come because they're working. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Yeah, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, $1,000, how much money do these folks spend a year?
How much do they spend a year?
Yeah, you have a ballpark?
It's hard to say. I figured anywhere between $1,000 and $5,000 maybe.
Yeah.
It depends. I mean, you figure what gas costs now. Mm-hmm. And radios are not cheap. Pagers are not cheap. And it's a lot of the expenses that is basically the gas and getting there and their costs of cleanup and things like that. And then the equipment that they buy. Gloves are not cheap. I mean, you can find antibacterial, big bottles of it at Costco and stuff like that, but you go through it, too.
I just want to follow up, please. This ain't a gift. This is a reimbursement for
them
really
supporting
is,
our community.
It really
so.
Is. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
And this is not unusual. There's several states that are doing that. I don't have at the tip of my tongue all the information. I know Mike has a lot more of that information than I do, so...
Representative Krieger?
Yeah, I just wanted to elaborate, Mr. Chair. Now, they have mandated increased training, which sometimes includes updating equipment to certain standards. And a lot of these, like I say, the small rural fire departments, where my son and daughter and daughter-in-law and the rest of them are all part of that, that comes out of their pocket. Then they lose weekends when they do these practice burns. And I believe about a year ago, they spent 4 or 5 days in Monmouth. It's something they had to go to for 4 or 5 days. They all had to take a week's wages off. They lost a full week's wages to go up there in order to be updated to the standard they had to be. So I think it's something that we need to step up and do. Very, very needed.
And I forgot to mention one other thing that you absolutely must have is your shots for Hep A and B, and they're six months apart or something, and they're about $100 to $150 for the Hep B shots. The A's are less, and I think it's a one-time shot. But a lot of the companies don't pay for that, don't have a budget to pay for that. And Rep. Krieger's right. It's coming down the tube right now, too, is the emergency medical services coordinator in the state health department is they're trying to equalize, standardize all the requirements for training, and that's going to cost more money. Right now I'm out of compliance with mine. I can't keep up with my training, especially when I'm down here, and so I have been designated the official flare setter for the Hamlet Fire Department. And I do a good flare set, I'll tell you.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
A couple of questions. First of all, do you know the fiscal on this? What's the potential universe of...
I do not know that at this point. I don't. We're busily trying to get some of this.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
The next question that I had, and you and I had discussed this, and I'm still unclear, on line 22, the individual has provided at least 3 years of volunteer service. What I'm trying to figure out is, does that mean you show up one day in 3 successive years, or is there some measurement of service that recognizes the people that are really serious about being volunteer first responders versus the ones that just kind of come and hang around the firehouse?
Well,
does such a distinction exist?
That is not really a reality. People don't just hang around the firehouse. When you're in a fire department, different departments probably have different rules. I can only speak for mine that I know of for sure. We have a 50% attendance for drills and calls, and you have to take the driving training. You have to take the training. If you provide any emergency medical service, you have to take the training for it. You have to become certified. It's very unlikely that someone in 3 years would just stop in once and not show up anymore. They would probably not be allowed on a scene. They would get a very stern talking to from the chief if they don't show up regularly. But it's hard to legislate volunteerism, too. That's what the name of the game is. You come when you can. A lot of people, there are lots of people who are more able to, able to come more often because maybe their employers don't let them off work for it, or they work in town and it's too much time to drive to show up to a call. Whereas, and you look across the state, a lot of the volunteer fire service, the average age is in the 40s and 50s now. And so some of these people are retired.
Would it be possible to put a number of hours in? Because I would presume in order to stay current and to be allowed to execute the kind of work, that there must be some minimum training requirements. So those would have to translate into hours where you were actually accounted for. And I just don't know whether you could tighten this. I'm trying to make the bill better. You could tighten this to reflect hours of service rather than the rather vague 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Senate Bill 459 does designate 100 hours. And
okay.
I've checked around.
I'm looking at 2670.
Yeah,
sorry.
But we're probably going to end up putting them together. But some of the chiefs have, when we asked them, they said they're okay with 100 hours if it goes to that. So.
And then one last question. Mm-hmm. I didn't get up to the ORSs, but the definition of rural under ORS Chapter 478, this body has struggled with rural in the past when we're providing malpractice relief for plastic surgeons in areas that I don't think that was ever intended. I want to make sure that we're really helping rural places, and I don't know what the definition of rural under 478 is. Staff could help us with.
Our goal with this was the volunteer services, mm-hmm. and in that case, I know what you're talking about, that case of that doctor. And most of the places that are in this that close to the urban areas are paid departments. And even if you call Tualatin Valley is not in your district, that's a paid department. And I'm talking about these are rural, unpaid. These are volunteers. They don't get paid for this.
Well, and it's all follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
It's all I'm trying to do is to be very precise in language that we intend to put into law so that we don't end up with a bunch of unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Scappoose, for example, is a mixture of volunteers and paid. It's within X miles of a metropolitan area. I don't want to exclude them because they're within, and I'm making this up because I don't
right.
have a definition.
Yeah.
I don't want to exclude them because they're within 50 miles of Portland.
And that's
and I conversely don't want to find out that we're helping out Portland to the exclusion of the rural folks that we're really trying to help.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to be very precise about what it is we're doing.
Well, I hear you, and I think the key word there is volunteer. Because if you have volunteer workers in a fire department in Scappoose, they would benefit by this, but the paid ones would not. But I will definitely follow up on the rural.
But then
to look at my ORSs.
Then we've got a lot of heavy definition on rural fire protection district means a rural fire protection district organized or subject to ORS Chapter 478. I don't want to exclude volunteers in Portland, so if the idea is to do rural, that's one thing. If it's any volunteers, I just want to know what we're doing.
And actually, in the drafting of it, Senator, we tightened that up to point out that it would be rural. And I hear what you're saying. And if there, I wasn't aware that Portland had any volunteers, but maybe they do.
The committee, if you would, please take a look at lines 20 through 23. That might help us because it does tighten it up and allows
which
Department
bill?
Of Revenue. This is 459. Representative Schopler.
I share the good senator's concerns about tight language. I couldn't agree more, and we want to make sure that everyone who deserves this gets it. But in Happy Valley, we don't have a lot of sidewalks, and we're right outside of Portland, and my wife thinks it's rural because we don't have sidewalks.
She
thinks we live in the country. So anyway,
her.
I don't know if that added anything to the conversation.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My experience is as a EMT provider and trainer as well in a rural community in eastern Oregon. At that time, and it's been a number of years, so I wouldn't presume to guess what the structure is right now. Our service was a city-owned service and provided on a volunteer basis, not with a rural fire protection district. So as I look at this, obviously there's some work that needs to be done to mesh the two because one is a $1,000 tax credit and one's a $250 tax credit. I would respectfully suggest that it be narrowed to simply say volunteer providers of first responder service, be that fire district volunteers or volunteer emergency medical technicians. There are a number of different ways of providing emergency medical service and emergency fire service. We're still talking about volunteers. I think you could actually take the rural references out and encompass all volunteers in that line of work, because I really don't think we're trying to get at a size of a community. We're talking about people who spend an inordinate amount of their personal time in training, in drilling, and in actual responses, and then obviously we need to mesh which amount it is and the fiscal impact of that. But I really think we could get around some of these questions if we eliminate rural and fire protection district, and you're going to end up with a product that aims at compensating volunteers in emergency response.
Well, I appreciate that, and you're absolutely right about the east side of the state. Last session, we held some hearings in the field, and my Health and Human Services Committee went to Baker City, and we heard from people who had driven an hour and more from there to come to our hearing, and they literally drove the ambulance because they were on the western end of their district at that point, and if they received a call, they would have had to go out the other way. And so they're driving their rigs, and they were not, it wasn't the fire department, it was the ambulance district, so it still is out there. It's very far and few between.
Representative Nelson, did you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Representative Boone. It's so nice to see you again.
I've been around.
And thank you so much for your service in this field that we're talking about. It makes me really proud of you.
Well, thank you.
And ones just like you who just saved my life 4 months ago, I'm most grateful. I am just on this rural issue, too, because I don't know if you consider my area rural or not in Yamhill County, but I'm like Mike's wife. I would just like to see this say, period. It doesn't have to be rural. It can just be unpaid volunteers. And that would make me so very happy. That's one. Two, I wondered if this couldn't just be a bottom line tax deduction. Bottom line, like your contribution to what is it? Political party or nonprofit? Since this is a nonprofit, I would think that would be wonderful and most deserving. And then next, of course, I want to see if we couldn't include our law personnel, our reserves, for example, who do the same thing, that hop out to help sheriff's reserves or in our
As long as
reserve. I just think it's the most wonderful. And last but not least, when we're doing this, maybe we could at least get you a free hepatitis check. We've tried that now since Randy Leonard was here in 2001. You think that, you know, along with this, maybe we could couple that. But the bottom line deduction would be wonderful. Reserves would include the law, law enforcement, too, and get out of rural. I think it's great.
We're happy to work with that.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're beginning to describe volunteers that go sometimes in their own peril to help others, I can't help but think of the folks that have been up on Mount Hood in this latest successful rescue, and the amount of wear and tear on their gear, and the amount of prep time and call-out time and meeting time and instructional time, and all of the issues that they have, not only as mountain climbers, but also as first responders at 12,000 feet. And so if we're continuing to expand this bill to recognize those that volunteer and use up equipment and time, I just don't want to be unmindful. This is a very popular topic right now, and thank God that this last one was successful. Mm-hmm. But the wear and tear on those guys
and
the training is certainly an issue as well.
I can't speak for Senator Metzger or Representative Patty Smith, whose bill we'll hear next, but I would be surprised if they wouldn't agree to that, too, as I would. I think we plan to all work to put these two together and whatever other ones are out there floating around to make the best possible bill that we can. And I have no problem with that, Senator.
The only thing I might suggest, and then we'll get to the representative, is that when we have folks who willfully go into a blizzard snowstorm and luckily they have the right equipment with them, we may want to have some fee that would, in fact, start to compensate for the tax expenditure that we're doing here. So that's just something I think we might want to think about.
I think there is a bill that Representative Lim has to do that, to require the use of them and to use these, you know, transponders or whatever they are, locators. They do cost something. So
right. You can rent them. Representative, you okay?
I'm good, thank you.
Are you talking to me, I hope?
No, it's Representative
Mr. Chair, you know, we started out with rural firefighting. We don't know the economic revenue impact's going to be, and you start including everybody, you're going to get it so big you can't afford to do what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And a good number of the people that are involved in the volunteer part of sheriff's offices and police agencies, a lot of them are doing that and prep for going, becoming part of those agencies when the time drags.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit different motivation for some of them.
Yes. Senator.
One of the best ways to get a new tax credit bill passed is to figure out which one we're going to get rid of. Because we are giving a lot of money away, twice the amount of our general fund. So when you add up all the tax credits, it's twice the amount of the general fund. And my advice to anybody that wants a tax credit is to go check it out and see which ones we can eliminate.
I thought somebody was doing that.
Well, you should be doing it. You have the bill.
I have the book, too.
So what's the fiscal impact, negative?
Well, we already talked about that.
Well, I was gone,
yeah.
So you're going to have to
And so we're
that.
Not going to tell you.
It's for us to know
we
and
don't.
To wonder.
Hey, I'm going to have to call the chair back in. If we don't
I'm sorry, Senator. I don't have a solid figure for you.
Okay, good.
Madam Chair, would you get back up here and take some
Okay.
time?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Donahoe.
Yes, thank you. I'm just curious a little bit about the resident or non-resident individual. Now, what is that meaning on line 18?
Are you in 2670?
2670, okay. Yes. Uh-huh. My bill.
I think. What line was that again?
18.
Mm-hmm. And that's another one of those described in an ORF chapter. And I don't know. I assume that as long as it fits the descriptions given and it's, you know, because it's if you say you moved, I don't know. I'd have to look at that. I'm sorry.
So I'm follow up, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, that gives rise to think that, you know, there might, heaven help with Krieger here for me to say that, there may need to be some reciprocity if we have individuals from Washington coming down to help us and us going up there to help them. And
I can't imagine how they could serve on a volunteer department and not live in the district. But
I think that could happen.
Odder things have come out.
Well, that's where the non-resident, yeah. That's what made me think of it, where that came from, I guess.
We'll be looking at all these bills very closely and putting together the best job that we can. And we'll get answers for that, too.
Any further questions for Representative Boone?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. On both bills, we have the same folks signed up. Steve Schneiderman and Nick Granum. Come on up, you guys. Give us your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Stephen Schneiderman. I'm from Coos Bay. I am the current president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. I'm here today to talk a little bit about volunteer firefighters and the importance of them. I'm sure most of you are familiar with Rotary Clubs and Rotary International and the motto of Rotary, service above self. Well, volunteer firefighters are, long before Rotary was thought of, were conducting or giving service well above self. There's a couple of bills I see here that we're talking about today. Right now we're talking about the House Bill 2670 and Senate, and soon Senate Bill 459. Volunteerism, especially in the fire service, is on the decline. Nationwide, statewide, communitywide. And any legislation that we can put together to give volunteers a recruitment and retention tool is very important to the community, the state, the nation, everywhere. So we are definitely in support of some type of legislation, some type of tax credit that will help these volunteer firefighters. Like Representative Boone said, these firefighters are giving hours upon hours of their time, the approximately 3 hours a week for your regular training. Then if your department has a safety committee, for example, which if you have 10 people or more on a department, by law you have to have a safety committee. Well, there's another meeting at least once a month that takes time, transportation, time for the volunteer away from their family, possibly away from their job. If they're a member of a specialized team or committee, if they're part of a hazmat team, hazardous materials, or a specialized rescue team, water rescue, a high angle rescue, any of those type of things, that requires X number of hours of additional training besides your regular firefighter training. If you want to be an apparatus operator, the person that drives the fire engine, that takes extra training. If your department has an aerial apparatus, a ladder truck, that takes additional training. Every step that you want to take in the fire service to help your community takes more of your time for OSHA-mandated training. Some of these classes are very difficult to get and very expensive to get. Can be seen that a specialized class that somebody needs to obtain that next level of certification, that firefighter might live in the south part of the state, might be in Phoenix or Talent or White City, but that class might be offered in Pendleton. They have to take time off from their job. They have the transportation to get there. Then there's the cost of the class. Some of those classes are very expensive. There's classes that are not heard of to be over $100 per student for these classes. I've been a firefighter volunteer firefighter for just shy of 25 years, and I can't begin to tell you the number of hours that I have put into this, away from the job, away from the family. My friends that are on the department, the same thing, and being from Coos Bay, I'm sure you all know that some of my friends paid the ultimate price, two of which were volunteer firefighters. I hope that we can, with these two bills and with, I hear a possibility of two more bills being introduced, I hope we can get all the players together and get one good piece of legislation that'll benefit most of the people in the best way. Can I answer any questions?
I'll let Schaffler go first.
Thanks.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I was a little kid in some of these small towns I lived in, the whistle would blow and people would just run off and go do whatever. So I grew up, I had no idea there was any training going on. I thought you just grabbed a fire hose. My question to you is, and if you don't have this on the top of your head, it's the same question I asked earlier. And I want to qualify it with, I do think we need to tighten this up. I agree with the representative here. We want to provide something for the good people out there, really first on the scene, taking care of us. But if you can find out some data on the average, just the average cost, it sounds like we're well over $1,000 a year with all that time training, if you estimate it at, $15-$25 an hour, time away from home, all the gas to and from, all the equipment. We're well over $1,000 already investment, and I just, if you have any data or if you have some ballparks or whatever you want to share with us, and if you don't have it now, it's fine, but I'd be interested to find out, because I think people just, if nothing else, need to know that investment's being made and that you all are contributing that, to say nothing of the risk you take when you're doing it. So
I do not have any hard data,
right.
But just on the outside training arena, there's there's a lot of training provided in-house or in your own fire department, but smaller departments don't have access to the more advanced training. And I'll try to give you an example. The Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association have an annual training conference, and it's 3 days of training. We are constantly trying to keep the cost down to the volunteers to attend this, but still, if like this year's conference will be in Coos Bay, that is a very long trip for firefighters in Baker City, Ontario, Pendleton, Klamath County, even the south. They're traveling. They have to come at least a day early to be there for the morning session. If they have a long travel, they're probably going to be there an extra day, so they're going to have 4 to 5 nights lodging. And the cost of lodging just for 1 weekend of training can be $400 or $500, plus the fuel and then time work. Usually they're using their personal vacation time.
Thank you.
All right, I believe we have another question. Is it from just you, Senator George?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just ran it. It's 4 weeks at 3 hours each. If they didn't show up for one other event, you're below minimum wage if we gave you this tax credit. And for that, of course, as was just pointed out, you're going to risk your life in order to provide this service to us. I don't know how we leave here without addressing this, because we have proven in this building that we can retain people in underserved rural areas by giving the most minuscule appearing subsidy in the form of a tax break. So I really think it's a great idea, and I want to thank you for your unbelievable service, because you'll run into a fire that would not be allowed to send one of my employees into because of the risk. And that's just an amazing sacrifice you guys make.
Well, you know, and that's all because of the great improvements in technology and equipment that we have. When I joined the fire service 25 years ago, it was a matter of going down to your fire station, signing up, getting fire gear, and you're a fireman. You had your drill night one night a week, and you learned while doing it. But the fire service has evolved immensely. Now we do have all the mandated training hours, and like I said, for the specialized rescue and hazardous materials teams, it's we're very well trained. And there's, you'll often hear the statement, just a volunteer. But those just a volunteers are going through the same required training that the firefighters that get a paycheck. The fire doesn't know the difference between a person that gets a paycheck and a person that volunteers. We put in many hours of our time, our family time. I'm off the job now to be up here because this is a very important matter to me.
Members of the committee, I have to tell you that Steve and I have been neighbors ever since I've been in Oregon, which is 37 years.
Oh, my goodness.
He's my next-door neighbor, and I'm so proud of him and the work that he does. And he comes from just a wonderful family. And I'm really proud of you today, Steve.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to move on to more questions for you. And Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Steve, for coming all the way up here to testify.
You.
I appreciate it. I know what you're talking about. And one thing that neither of us mentioned is the increasingly we're finding when we respond to a call, often too late, you've run into something that's a meth house. And that adds a whole other level of risk and potential harm. And not only that, but we have run into, I'm sure you have too, pets. And sometimes people's pets are trained to attack even the people who are supposed to help them. So there's a lot of things that happen, and you just kind of take it in stride. And as the Representative or Senator Berger has lucky to have you as her next-door neighbor, you're going to be helping her someday, maybe. You know, and the people you help are your neighbors and your friends, and especially in the smaller areas, you know who they are in your district, and that it's nice to help them, but sometimes it makes it really, really hard too. So,
Representative
you.
Krieger?
Madam Chair, could you maybe address a little bit in the rural areas, unincorporated areas, the effect of not having access to or not being part of a rural fire district, what that does to the insurance rates of those people? And then go back to your situation talking about the difficulty of recruiting or bringing newer, younger people into the process, which you might think is the main contributing factors of those, of that, those two issues.
Okay, on the unincorporated areas, and I guess I can speak best about our region, we have a service called Coos Forest Protective Association. And if a person lives up Coos River outside the, when leaving Coos Bay, there's a Timber Park Rural Fire Protection District. And once you leave that district boundaries, you're unprotected. If you have a fire, the Coos Forest Protective Association will respond to make sure their trees don't burn up. And that's the level of their training. And it's important to get fire service extended all over the state. I don't know how to resolve that at this time. Get the people that live in those areas to form another fire district, and then you got to start the process all over again. You got to get the mandated hours of training, and you have to somehow get the equipment. It's a never-ending process. I hope I've answered the question that you were trying to ask me.
I'm sure. Follow-up? I think the thing I'm trying to get at, and I think people understand it already, but when you do not have or you're not served by a fire department district, your insurance rate is considerably higher.
Yes, it is.
And so society's going to pay the bill if those rural fire departments leave.
Correct.
And so I think that's the thing we want to understand. It's going to cost us more, and this is just a good investment. And the other part is whether or not you think there's some contributing causes to why it's getting harder to recruit.
Oh, definitely. This society is much busier than it was 25 years ago when I joined. It was fun. It was a very social. It was kind of like a club. But when the bell went off, the horns went off, the page went off, you know, the atmosphere changed to all business, getting out there, fighting the fire, saving lives. But society is busier now with more two-family incomes, people working to make ends meet, especially in the rural settings where the income is lower. It's really hard to get firefighters, and they it's not really super hard to get them. They come and want to join, but then they see, oh my gosh, it's going to take this many hours to just become a firefighter so that I can help my community. And yeah, I want to volunteer to do that. I mean, volunteering is very important, but I can't afford to volunteer now. And it's that's what it's coming down to. You can't afford to volunteer, because when I joined up, it wasn't harming me. I was volunteering. I mean, the potential harm was always there, but now, on average, it costs the average person over $1,000. From the numbers we just kind of put together, to be a volunteer.
Yes, Senator Morse.
I totally support the program, and I will support the tax credit. However, it just kind of bothers me a little bit that we are afraid to raise taxes. We don't want to raise taxes for a variety of reasons, but we do have huge tax credits. That's the easy thing to do, is to do the tax credit. And I think we have to keep that in mind. I will support this program. I understand the need for rural Oregon, parts of Oregon that's underserved, that where you don't have a tax base, to have a regular fire department. You rely on volunteers. I understand the insurance rates going up. I understand the expense of volunteering, and I applaud you for doing that, and I will support this issue, but it's just something that we have to keep in mind in terms of the investment and where the money comes from, because we're cutting other programs, and you know there's just so much money to go around. But I, you know, we keep talking about looking at tax expenditures. There's a big list, a big thick book of $30 million that goes out in tax expenditures, and I think we have to make a concerted effort to try to identify some that we can get rid of in order to do some of the ones that are really, really worthy. So I will support this issue.
Thank you very much.
And I think the senator, I agree with him on we need more revenue, and he hit nail right on the head on where the money comes from. And it, look, and you've all heard it come out of my mouth before, but you're going to hear it again whenever we talk about taxes and revenue. This state's sitting on a gold mine of natural resources and land and an army of people that know what to do with it. All we have to do is reach down and take advantage of it, especially in the rural communities who have been denied the ability to take advantage of their natural resources, not just by the state government, but by the federal government as well. So if I'm all for having the discussion about the tax credits, Senator and committee members, mm-hmm. but we also have to have the discussion about timber and water, and we're having a big one about land use, which could have been prevented. All these things are all tied together, and it's very vexing for me to sit here and watch timber burn up and rot because, in my opinion, a small number of people think that's the best thing to do with our natural resources here in Oregon. And I just wanted to share that. So if we're going to talk about where the money comes from, I'm all for that.
Representative Shoffler, Steve Schneiderman probably understands exactly what you're talking about.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Coos Bay Boy, you're speaking his language, I imagine. Steve, thank you very much. I'm going to call up now, next, I'm going to call Becca from
thanks.
Representative Senator Metzger's office, because he has Senate Bill 459, so we'll have Becca from his office.
I know I don't look much like the senator, but I'll do my best. For the record, my name is Becca Feathers, and I'm a legislative assistant for Senator Rick Metzger. He regrets that he couldn't be here this afternoon, but he has asked me to speak on his behalf, so I will do my best to answer your questions. I am here in support of Senate Bill 459, which provides an alternative tax credit method to show our appreciation for the crucial services provided by volunteer first responders. The senator recognizes that 8 of the 10 members of this committee are co-sponsors on House Bill 2670, so the statement may not be necessary, as you clearly already understand the importance of the issue. However, I'd like to briefly highlight the main difference between these two bills, which has already been discussed briefly here. Under House Bill 2670, an individual must volunteer his or her services as a first responder for at least 3 years before qualifying for the tax credit. After this time, the individual qualifies for a $1,000 credit. The bill does not take into account the number of hours volunteered in any of the given years, nor does it consider the bigger picture of commitment and sacrifice when determining this tax credit. Senate Bill 459 looks beyond the single factor of prior years of service, focusing instead on the total picture of commitment by an individual. Under this bill, a person qualifies for a $250 credit once they have volunteered 100 hours in a single tax year. This is a significant amount of time, and we believe it represents an individual's serious commitment to service. The senator supports Senate Bill 459 because he believes it more accurately reflects our desire to appropriately reward those volunteers who sacrifice their time and safety in our service. Especially in rural areas of the state, volunteers are crucial in any emergency response, often dedicating many hours of their own time. The senator believes that he shares the committee's desire to honor the significance of this commitment, which he thinks is reflected more clearly in Senate Bill 459. I'd like to close by noting that regardless of which bill the committee decides to move forward, we are proud that we are at last publicly recognizing the sacrifices made by volunteer first responders. They deserve this type of recognition, and we are grateful we found a way to thank them for their service.
Thank you very much, Becca. You did a very good job for Senator Metzger, and I'm certainly going to pass that on to him.
Thank you.
Any questions for Becca?
Just one quick one. Becca, when I look at, and I was looking at your bill when I gave the lines certain. Okay, but anyway, in that, the Department of Revenue has the right to just draft an administrative rule to deal with the issue, and then it says that it'll require a form that's signed by the chief authorizing that this, in fact, is a legitimate person deserving the credit. Are you comfortable with that? Have you guys talked about whether we need to go beyond that for additional qualifiers? It appears to me everything's in the bill that needs to be there.
I'm not sure. I think the idea is that the form would certify that that person had actually worked 100 hours. And it is, that line is actually in both bills.
In both bills, that's mm-hmm. correct.
All right. Thank you very much, Becca. We have another volunteer firefighter here, Nick Renner.
Hi.
You'll identify yourself for the record, please.
Okay. Nick Granum. I'm a director with the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association and a resident volunteer with Walton Valley Firefighters. I guess I'll address some of the questions you had really quick. I won't take very much of your time, but I'm new to the volunteer fire service. I've been doing it for about 2 years. I'm a resident volunteer, so we provide shift coverage at an all-volunteer station in Walton Valley. And recruitment and retention is a huge issue, even for a department like the Walton Valley Fire and Rescue, where we have a lot of people. We've lost a lot of volunteers in the last few years, and along with a lot of other departments, mainly because of the reason that Steve said it costs a lot to be a volunteer. Some of the people at my station put in 200 or 300 hours every month, not just every year. With resident coverage, it's 12-hour shifts, so we cover nights and weekends, and it's all on a volunteer basis. So I guess from my perspective, it's very expensive to be a volunteer, and anything that the state can do to reimburse that makes a huge difference, if only, like you said, giving people the impression that they're appreciated. So that's it.
All right. Thank you, Nick, for being here. Any questions? All right. Boom.
Just like to thank you, Nick, and if you ever want to join the Hamlet Fire Department, we can use some younger blood.
All right. Thank you.
Representative
Nelson.
Thank you. Just a quick question, and I'm sure it's probably easily answered. But first of all, Nick, thank you. And you, young men like you, make me so proud. And I'm sure the chief appreciates having you young people coming aboard. At the current time, I don't mean this to be personal, but aren't you allowed by law to take some of your expenses for volunteering against your income tax?
That's a good question. Yeah. Things you can write off, things like boots that you buy, duty boots, gloves that aren't provided by the
or
department.
Uniforms.
Uniforms are provided by a lot of the departments, but some aren't. So, and that makes a difference.
How about mileage?
Yes, follow up.
I believe I've just finished filling out my 1040, so mileage can be counted.
Equipment.
Things that you buy. So it's the it goes cuts down on your the overall amount that you're taxed on. So that makes a difference. It's different than a tax credit, I believe.
Right. But a deduction.
Yeah, deduction.
All right.
Just comment on appreciate Representative Nelson's comments, but I have to just give a qualifier here. And usually when your pager goes off, and in our area it's more spread out probably than yours is, I keep mileage for my work-related driving and stuff, but I'll tell you, I do not write that down. I don't sit there and look at the odometer and see what I've got. You know, I just go. And I'm sure that a lot of people wouldn't be able to keep mileage, just like you're reacting, you know, you're getting there as fast as you can.
One thing I want to add, I guess, is that the cost of fire service in the state, this goes to the collective fiscal side, we're going to pay for it anyway. So I guess if we pay for it with volunteers and go that route, or if we lose all our volunteers, then we'll have to pay for it somehow. So it'll make a big difference, I think, for the state to pay for it up front rather than paying for it after the fact when we lose everybody.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I hate to say that, to do this, but I've just been handed testimony from the requester of the bill, and I'd like to read it into the record.
All right.
Do you need me to go there, or do you want me to?
No, you can do it right there.
Okay. And this is from a phone conversation from Mike Johnson from Sandy Beach Fire, and he just lists some things to keep the guys we have got and to get new recruits. There's a huge time commitment for volunteer firefighters and EMS people. Today in Seaside, there were 6 calls. In the summer, it can be upwards of 12 a day. Time is going back and forth, gas it takes to get to the stations, time for special training, which Steve talked about. We do it because we love it and we want to help people, but this tax credit would make a difference to those of us already involved and would help us recruit new volunteers.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Boone.
Thank you for
that. It shall be added into the record. All right, Ed Patterson and Dave Lapai. I understand that you have a little history of some of this, and perhaps that
personally
might be
together, or,
no, together is fine. That we might be able to make wiser decisions with your help.
Well, I do have a little history, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ed Patterson, and I am representing the Oregon Rural Health Association. Last session, I was approached by some Eastern Oregon volunteers indicating that they were having a hard time recruiting volunteer EMTs and that it would be helpful if we had a tax credit. So I spoke with Representative Tom Butler about his interest in doing something like that, and he had a bill drafted, and the bill was referred to his committee. We thought we were creating a $250 tax credit for rural EMTs, and part of the bill in the existing law is that the Office of Rural Health would do the administrative work and do the eligibility testing to see if the individual actually worked as a volunteer EMT. The bill eventually passed, and the requirement was the individual had to work 20% of their time on volunteer EMTs. And we thought that was probably a good way to monitor whether the person was actually a volunteer or not. Then this session, Representative Greg Smith had a little bill introduced that would change the eligibility requirements. That bill is House Bill 2500. And he asked me to come to his office and talk about it because he knew my involvement in the last session. And we felt that possibly that wouldn't solve his problem. The problem he had was a full-time paid rural EMT was also serving as a voluntary EMT in another small town over in Eastern Oregon. So he had a hearing. We had a hearing over in our house side about a week ago or so, and agreed to change the eligibility requirement to 100 hours of voluntary time, thinking that, well, all the time you've heard about the commitment volunteers have to have, that 100 hours would be easily attained, and it would encourage those who are paid EMTs to also work as volunteer EMTs, maybe some of the areas who wouldn't have EMTs otherwise. So the subcommittee actually approved that amendment. The bill is still over in Senate Health, or the House Health Committee, but that was the my first glance that we had conflicting volunteer EMT bills. And that bill we passed last session will only pertain to EMTs, but the Office of Rural Health was put in an administrative capacity to make the judgments on who gets the money and who doesn't. And they were willing to do that with no boost in staff time. And the director of the Office of Rural Health, Scott Ekblad, came down and testified the day we had that House Bill 2500 up. and indicated that what we thought we were doing, creating a tax credit for the tax year 2005, but finally, and we found out that, and when the Department of Revenue went over it, said, no, you didn't do that. The first tax credit year you can have is 2006, based on the way the wording was in the bill. So currently, the Rural Health, the Office of Rural Health, has sent out letters to all the EMTs in the state saying if you qualify for a certain percentage of your time as a volunteer, here's your application, and they can add, they can apply online also, which is very revealing. But I talked to the staff person who was doing that for the Office of Rural Health today, and she said they have received about 350 applications for the current tax year, and they're coming in at the rate of about 20 a day. So as these people are filling out their tax returns, they're beginning to realize that they are eligible for this $250 tax credit. And she said they are not sure about how many they're going to get, but if the rate keeps up until April 15th, they're liable to have close to 1,000 applications. But they're just guessing at this point. Part of the bill we passed last session requires the Office of Rural Health to make a report to this legislative body about the implications. Because the ruling was they could, the first year they could get their credit was for 2006, and they probably won't have too much to tell you, but even an update of where they are with that would be helpful. So when I read these two bills, one of them requires the, obviously they both increase the number of people and the volunteer professions that would be covered. But the Office of Rural Health is also the administrator for the physician, Rural Physician Tax Credit Program, which is $5,000 a year credit. And they charge the physicians $25 per year to administer that program and collect all the data and provide it to the Department of Revenue. But with a $250 tax credit, they didn't feel like they could charge EMTs any money for handling such a small amount of tax credit. So they're doing it pro bono. And the girl, the lady I talked to today said that she works about five months a year, every tax year, just administering the program. And I know that Scott Ekblad has told me that they would really like to have some more money in their budget to cover some administrative costs. So I can tell you that if, I don't know what the committee decides, but I think there's a lot of confusion not only between the two bills, but also between the existing law. I was surprised to see that the legislative council didn't use the existing law to draft the changes you sponsored wanted. And so you've got some conflict between the existing law and like one of the bills, I'm not sure which one, requires the Department of Revenue to handle the administrative requirements. And you theoretically could have one law governing those who were eligible in 2006, which would be the Office of Rural Health. And then if this new law passes, it would be the Department of Revenue for those who are newly eligible that come on. It could both be EMTs. So I would hope that you could bring all the stakeholders together, and certainly the Office of Rural Health, because they're the most experienced agency with this, and maybe sit down and hammer out something that's that you can measure in terms of the fiscal impact, which will sooner or later have to be done anyway. But that would be my recommendation. Steve Leipoff is works with the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, and I contacted him last session, for some assistance in getting some EMTs involved in the debate last time. So he worked closely with the committee as I did last session. Dave, any comments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. As Ed said, my name is Dave Leipoff. I am past president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. I was still a board member last session. And I'm a current volunteer lieutenant with the Kaiser Fire District. I applaud you for bringing this conversation to the surface. Volunteer recruitment and retention, as you've heard, is critical. I think tax credits are a really good, excellent way to get there. But there's a lot of concern, I guess, I have, and it kind of bothers me a little bit to even take the other side of this. Ed talked about the potential numbers when we did this last session, and we didn't know what we were looking at. We know there's approximately 8,500 volunteers, firefighter and combination EMTs in the state. We know that we had to establish some criteria to narrow that pool down, and the criteria that the Office of Rural Health determined was 25 miles from a population of 30,000. So hold on to that number for a minute. We guesstimated, and we'll know maybe in October, that to be somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 people that would qualify and possibly apply for this tax credit. That would have a fiscal impact at the $250 of roughly $375,000. If you took all 8,500 people at $250, you're talking over $2 million. If you bump it to 1,000, you can do the math. I think tax credits are the way to do it. I think we just have to be very careful because this last session was the first time a tax credit was ever given to a volunteer of any discipline. I don't want to see that get lost in this new legislation. Ed and the Office of Rural Health really went to bat for this. Representative Butler, there's a lot of people that it was an uphill battle last session. And the focus was really to get EMTs in the rural setting and retain them there. You've heard about the fire service and running into buildings, and I love fire service. I love pulling a nozzle. The reality is 85% of what we do is EMS calls. The majority of folks are EMTs. We're taking care of chest pains and shortness of breath and picking up grandparents and little kids and everybody else off the floor, and that is the bulk of what we do. Fire service requires a lot of dollars, gets a lot of prominence in the newspaper, but it's really EMS that is the backbone of first response. When you talk about all first responders, then do you start looking at the community emergency response teams, the CERT teams? Do you look at the search and rescue teams? When you include those groups, you can push in this number to 12,000. If you start offering a $1,000 tax credit, which I want to see that happen, and I'm sure there's a lot of financial ways to do it and revenue sources you can bring in, but that's a huge fiscal impact. I recognize the reality of that. And I'm sure as revenue and everybody else starts looking at this, I'm sure all you, the committee members, will hear of this. I'll kind of touch on some of the points I heard. Somebody mentioned the qualification for participation. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, they authorize a fire department's training officer to sign off on a firefighter's training to say that they met that requirement. So to give that authority to a chief or a chief officer really isn't a long stretch. That's an already accomplished task, and there's already validation for how that works well. So I think that's a reasonable thing to do. It was talk of expenses, I'll kind of tie that into hours. I pulled, over the last week, 10 days, a dozen departments, and I've got ranges from 100 hours a month, or 100 hours a year of volunteer time donated to roughly 800 to 1,000 hours a year, and everything in between. And those can be departments that train and do 10 calls a month or a year to departments like I do at Kaiser, where we do 3,600 calls a year. So there's a wide variety there. The administrative costs, Ed talked about the Office of Rural Health. I don't know how you separate the EMTs from the volunteer, the firefighters. I mean, do you just call them all volunteers? And then do you call them all, and if you call them all volunteers, do you qualify that with a distance from a population base? I met with a number of you folks, I'm forgetting the date, last fall, down in Florence, at a kind of a town hall meeting, and we talked about how to broaden that to incorporate more people to be eligible for the tax credit. When I look at some of the areas just locally here to Salem, to get Lyons and Staten and Scio, just to pick three local, small, what I call rural communities, you would have to bring that number into 15 miles from a population of 30,000. The people at my department and myself at Kaiser, unless you just open it up to all volunteers, will never qualify. Kaiser has a population of 34,000 people. I'm not sure what the population of Coos Bay, North Bend is, or Albany is, but you're going to find a lot of fairly large little cities that will rule out people if you have that qualifier. But if you don't have that qualifier, I don't know how you make it a manageable number. I want to see tax credits. I want to see everything we can do in the state to help recruit and retain volunteers. But I want to do it with my reality hat on and not every dream I've ever had. So I have a couple other pieces, but I think I'd rather answer questions if there are any. Oh, one last piece, the resident, non-resident issue. We have citizens that live in Washington that volunteer in Oregon and also in Idaho that volunteer, and those would be the resident, non-resident component, where they come across, they stay at the station, maybe they work part-time in the state of Oregon, so they would have a tax liability from the state of Oregon that the tax credit would work against. So,
all right. Questions?
Thank you.
Any questions? All right, Senator Johnson.
I think this is excellent testimony, and I appreciate you being so broad-thinking to say, you know, this might be in my self-interest to see this bill passed, but I also feel a civic responsibility to raise historic issues and other issues, and just as you described, creating a universe with 12,000 people potentially in it. This may be another one of these bills coming out of this committee that would profit from some kind of a convocation of a work group to begin to figure out what is it that we're trying to accomplish here and what's the best methodology, and to get a fiscal and put some sideboards on. If it's recognizing volunteers, that's one thing. If we want to narrow it to rural, that's another thing. I'm not sure that we've got enough information right now to we don't even know what bills are out around, much less their conflict with existing law. And it just seems to me that we would profit from a subset of this committee doing some additional work on what is a very fine idea, but maybe is not quite ready right now.
If I may. Chair yes. Berger, Senator Johnson, you bring an excellent point up. There is a number of bills out, and some are on the Senate side and some are on the House side, and there is not one place where they'll all converge. I've been warned not to use the term work session or work group already, and admonished for even broaching that subject, but there does
you
need
didn't
to be some mechanism. Yeah, I understand your appreciation for that. There does need to be some mechanism where we can bring these pieces of legislation together and see if there is a compromise piece that we can hammer out, because I firmly believe this is excellent legislation, and the fact that we're having a discussion is well overdue, but we do need to bring all these different pieces together. And I would just, Ed Patterson, Ken Armstrong, who represents the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters, Janet Wingram, Oregon Special District Directors, to work with those folks to, I don't know, it's kind of above my pay range to figure out how that process exactly works. But
Senator Morset?
There's another approach to this, and we have Ed and I have a bill that is about for $8.2 million that would go to part of the problem for EMT training. That's upfront money. We're looking at cigarette money and or economic development money, and my conversations with the governor's office has been on economic development in rural Oregon. Because you need the infrastructure. Now, I was talking more of the healthcare infrastructure and the EMTs, but I think that, you know, rural Oregon, and I agree with Representative Schaffler. I'm from Montana, and we tear our state apart, and we do all kinds of things, and then let the next generation put it back together again. I think, though, that we can better use our natural resources. I think that there are ways that we can enhance our natural use or resource receipts in rural Oregon, because there is that great divide now. There is no resource base, economic resource base available. But I think we have to look at different, you know, a number of different funding mechanisms, and a tax credit, I think, is part of it. Economic development funding, maybe using lottery money, is another aspect of it that we need to look at. So, but I do think we need to get a handle on how much we're talking about and where and so on. And the rural designation is somewhat artificial, because there are communities of need that are not designated rural that we need to take care of. So I think you're correct there, but It's an issue that has to be dealt with.
I guess my question is, we have Representative Boone and Senator Metzger, and then you said there are a couple of other bills, maybe over in the House side, and besides the legislators and perhaps Scott from Rural Health, who else, Ed, would you suggest needs to be brought into this discussion?
Well, Dave has been my expert with the EMT guide. He's also an expert with the firefighter portion of this, too. So I would think if he has the time, he'd be a key person or someone like him. I know he has the interest and the knowledge.
Okay. And should we have representatives from volunteer firefighters and representatives from the EMTs that are actively involved in that at this time?
Chair Berger, I would say you should, if possible, have somebody from the Oregon Volunteer Firefighter Association. I don't officially represent them. I didn't mention it, but I'm also a committee member of the EMT Advisory Committee, a subcommittee of the Board of Medical Examiners, and I represent the rural component of the EMTs on that board to some degree, and then I do a number of projects with the Department of Human Services, EMS and Trauma Section. So between myself and the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters and then the Office of Rural Health, I feel very confident that we could represent the rural EMS component.
Well, we've had two people testify today, one a staff person, one the president of the organization, Volunteer Firefighters. All right. Reverend Spoon, did you want to add anything to discussion?
No, I'm happy to do that and even help facilitate it, you know, so we can get it done and get going on it and get something done. And in the meantime, you know, charge you, Dave, because you're so good at ferreting out all this stuff with finding out the bills that are out there. So so we can make sure they're...
Mr. Keller, did you need a staff person? Is that how I understand this interpretation?
I thought I saw a chair volunteering.
Mr. Keller and I go back to the Kaiser days a little bit, so I was pleasantly surprised to see him as your staff person for this committee.
I think we all want the same thing.
And, right. And Senator Gerard?
I'm about to bust. There are 40 names of legislators on this bill, okay? And we, when I came into this building 10 years ago, the budget was $24 billion. Now it's going to be over $40,000 million. And when I look at a little number like this, I'm thinking, and I just look at the revenue. I serve on the Revenue Committee. We've looked at that book full of these supposed tax breaks, these expenditures. And the point of this is, do you know how little that number is that if we took the... Okay, you both understand how little that number is.
If I may respond to Chair Berger, Senator George, I do appreciate that. And last session when we were fighting for something less than $400,000, we both sat there and said, this is nothing. It's only $250 tax credit. It's not even $500,000. You know, what seems to be the challenge here? And with that encouragement, I think we should go for the $1,000 tax credit for all 13,000 possible volunteers in the state. I'm good with that. That will be your battle at some point, not mine, and I'll be right there to support you, though. Yes. You have my support.
I could do a follow-up.
Follow-up.
I asked a question of our staff a few minutes ago. Could we add anything to those upper lines? And the answer was yes. You can't change related to. And what I would like to see in this is, whereas the Legislative Assembly finds that we put something, a second line in there, this is my recommendation, that expresses the great appreciation on behalf of the legislature and the people of Oregon for those people who volunteer. And I just would think that would be what either bill that goes forward to slip in a line that says, whereas the Legislative Assembly finds the great contribution and sacrifice of time and everything else would be appropriate statement.
Thank you. All right.
How about a surcharge on people who earn over $1 million a year?
Good.
Okay. Put that in, too.
Wow. Senator Marcet, you have some great ideas.
Hey, why not?
All right. All right. Thank you very much, for giving us a historic perspective. We have an informational presentation to be made now by Dr. Easton. And Dr. Easton is not here. Dr. Holly Easton is Dr. Bates' wife, Senator Bates' wife, and so I'm going to ask you, committee, to stand at ease for 5 minutes until we can locate the difficulty in your head.
So Senator Bates' wife is here? Mm-hmm.
She's going to be here. She's been working at...
I just saw her picture.
Members, we are unable to get in touch with Judith Callens. And she is the person who has been in contact with Dr. Easton. So I am going to presume that Dr. Easton is not going to get here. So I'm going to, there's no other business, I'm going to call the meeting adjourned. Okay.